Hi, this is Pete Worrell with Bigelow, introducing you to another episode of the Positive Enterprise Value Podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to have as my guests, my friends and clients, Dave and Cindy Francis, who have kind of a hero's journey to tell you about. Dave and Cindy have had many chapters in their journey as entrepreneurs. They started out with Cindy growing up in a family business that was run by her dad, Fred Fowler, who himself was a second-generation owner. And she tells us a little bit of the story about what that was like growing up with her dad as a wild man entrepreneur, getting together and marrying David Francis, Dave spending some time in the business, then leaving the business, and Dave and Cindy moving to the middle part of the country, going out on their own, actually having some entrepreneurial experiences of their own, moving back to the East Coast, starting up a different company. And then ultimately, when Cindy's father, Fred, was diagnosed with a terminal illness, Dave coming back into the business in the breach, theoretically, temporarily, to kind of solve some problems with the business, and now just having come through a very successful recapitalization, telling about their dreams and hopes for the next chapter. So I think Dave and Cindy have a story that is particularly rich with lessons and comedy, humor, things to focus on, things not to do. And any entrepreneur, owner, manager, or aspiring entrepreneur will get a hell of a lot out of it. I sure hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. One of the questions I had for you is, I've heard so much about your father, Fred,
mm-hmm.
and I feel cheated that I didn't get a chance to meet him, because in my view, the stories I've heard about him is that he would be, and what I say with this with great affection, was a severe entrepreneur.
Yes.
What are your earliest memories of your dad as an entrepreneur?
Well, just that he commands a room. When he walks in a room, he commands it. He's the biggest person there, and it's usually his ideas over anybody else's. He always was looking for the next opportunity. I remember when Dave and I moved, Dave had worked for him prior years. We ended up moving to Michigan, and Dave was not working for him anymore. And I remember driving with him in the car through, I can't remember the name of the town.
You're in like Novi or something.
Novi. Yeah. And we passed all of these businesses, and he just wanted to get out of the car so bad and go knock on these doors.
Yeah, I bet they need my product. I bet you they need my product.
That's a definite guy that could use us. Look at that machine shop. Look at that. And that's when I think that for me was something that stood out as why he would be considered an entrepreneur, just always looking for opportunity.
And Dave, how did it come that you happened to join the business the first time?
I was in real estate, and 2008 hit, and real estate wasn't looking particularly promising for the next several years, and Fred said to me, you know, I'm actually in a position right now where I need somebody, and if you're ever going to come to the company, now would be a really good time. And you know, those two things together seem pretty good. We had a young family, and that we needed to support, and so I said, yeah, sure, let's give it a shot, with the understanding that I knew absolutely nothing about metrology. I knew about sales. I knew how to lead a sales team. But I knew absolutely nothing about metrology. He said, don't worry about that. We can teach you that.
And so what did you find when you got there?
What I found was that, the first thing that I remember was, you know, I'd been in the real estate game, and the real estate game is a very different game. It's a very, you know, you're negotiating very big deals. It's taking a very long time for these deals to close. Cindy and I would spend a lot of sleepless nights waiting for checks to come in, and I just remember the first day being at Fowler and watching the fax machine at that time, date myself, you know, just kept spitting out orders. And I said, wow, this is great.
Yeah, right.
This is a sea change from what I'm used to.
Yeah, the velocity and the frequency of the feedback.
The frequency of the orders, yeah. Right? Yeah. And the other thing was that in the real estate game, you know, it was oftentimes very confrontational. And the other thing that really impressed me right off with the metrology is that it was not a confrontational space. Our customers were, they liked us, they wanted to do business with us, we were friendly, you know, our suppliers were friendly, and it was just a much more, just the business was much more enjoyable.
Not adversarial.
Yeah, that's the thing that, those are the things that really struck me early on. Yeah.
So as the two of you think about the chapters of either your life or your life and the business, you went into that chapter after 2008, and then the chapter came to an end. Why was that?
I think that, you know, when Fred and I initially talked about me coming to work for him, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, I'm going to be retiring someday, and, you know, I'd really like, you know, you to be part of that. And I think he was trying to, you know, and after 5 years, it turned out that that really wasn't his intention at all. He wanted to stay there as long as he physically could do it. And you know, entrepreneurs, and I'm guilty of the same thing, but you get to a point where you get, you know, you get a little adverse to risk, and he was at that point where he was running the company. We've talked about it being, you know, a bit of a lifestyle business, mm-hmm. and I think that he was entering that lifestyle phase. He was certainly an entrepreneur still, but he was becoming more risk adverse. Mm-hmm. I was out as the director of sales. I was out meeting with the customers and understood pretty clearly what we needed to do to grow our market. And I would come back to him and say, we got to do this, 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 and this. And he would say, yeah, those are all really good ideas, but we're not going to do any of it. And I think after 5 years of that, it was kind of clear to me that really what he wants me to do is come in and turn the lights on, turn the lights off, and wait for him to be done doing this. And to me, that just wasn't a really exciting proposition. And so we had some difficult discussions. But ultimately, we said that, you know, this just isn't, you know, you're an amazing father-in-law. I love you. You're an amazing grandfather to our kids, grandmother. You know, we love you guys desperately, and, you know, we appreciate the opportunity, but this is just not, you know, this is not our life plan.
Right.
To you know, just be caretakers of Fowler. If you want me there, I'm going to grow it, and I want to have an active role in growing it. And if that's not the plan, then we got to do something different. And
wow, so you guys are brave. I mean, here you were living in the place near where you grew up.
Yeah.
With near your parents, Cindy, and in the business that your dad had run. And Dave's taking, I'm going to guess, more responsibility particularly for the external facing part of the business.
Yeah.
And are you being successful doing that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, being sure. Successful doing that. And I'm going to guess that Fred, when he said he really wanted to think about retirement, that in fact he was intellectually honest, that is what he knew he should do, but
he wasn't ready to
put his heart
hand over the
let
reins.
Him do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It was hard. We walked away from an opportunity.
And so, what did you do?
I went to a company. You know, Fowler at that time was, you know, rough number, $16 million probably. And the company that I went to work for, you know, I immediately doubled my salary, so that was kind of nice. You know, at that age with a young family, that was kind of nice. And we went to work for a company that was $300 million.
Yeah.
And in the Fowler product line at that time, probably 4,000 product SKUs. And the company that I went to had 500,000 product SKUs. And in the industrial distribution, and more broadly in industrial distribution. So we were selling cutting tools, we were selling abrasives, we were selling fluids, we were selling, you know, a broad range of everything that you would use in a manufacturing facility. Whereas at Fowler, I was really in this very niche world of metrology, measuring and quality control and inspection equipment. So I didn't understand it at the time, but, you know, as you go through life, you know, these the pieces start to fall together and you look back and you go, okay, that made sense. But at the time, looking back on it, that was an incredible move for me.
Lots of learning and growing, right?
Lots of learning and growing.
Yeah.
And I got to meet so many people in the industry that I would otherwise have never been able to meet. I got to understand what a $300 million company looks like and works like, and how you have to think about scaling and people. So it was an amazing, looking back on it, if Fred knew what I was going to learn going and doing this for 5 years at this company in Michigan, he probably would have said, you should go do that anyway.
Yeah, that's great.
Because you're going to get an education, you're going to get a PhD in industrial distribution, where here, you'll learn what I can teach you, but you're not going to get the broader picture. So it was interesting.
You're reminding me of a story that I was with a woman one day in Montreal who is the chair of the board of a public company that her family controls. And we were just chatting, and I said to her, gee, you have siblings, I think, don't you? Yes. And your dad is still with us? Oh, yes. He's very proud of the company. And your siblings are not in the business? She said, no, they're not. And I said, but yet you're the chair of the board. And yep, I am. And why? Well, how did that happen? And she said, well, very simple. My father had a rule, 2, 3, 4. And I said, what's 2, 3, 4? She said, well, you had to have 2 degrees, you had to speak 3 languages, and you had to work somewhere else for 4 years. And she said, no, speaking 3 languages sounds daunting, but we're in Montreal.
Right.
So it means I needed to learn one more language.
Right.
And, I'm an attorney as well as having an undergraduate degree. And then, I worked for another large global corporation for 4 years. I said, boy, your dad was smart. Right?
Very smart.
Yeah. So there you are in Michigan. What makes you come back east?
When we went to Michigan, this is an interesting, anybody that's been through this understands the implications not only on, your business life, but certainly on your personal life, your family, your marriage. This was going through this process of leaving Fowler and Cindy not walking away, but, putting some distance between her mother, her father, the business, taking the grandchildren, upheaving them and bringing them to Michigan. These are all life-changing, serious events.
Yeah.
Looking back on them, it doesn't seem like it was that tough a decision, but at the time it was horrible. It really was. But I never have been, so proud of Cindy in, her just saying, at some point in time, she just looked at me and said, Dave, you're my husband. This is our life together. If this is what we have to do, this is what we have to do, and, I'm with you. And that's, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But she did put a condition on it. I'm with you, but.
I'm with you.
I'll
give you 5 years.
Oh.
Yeah, she said at the end of 5 years, we're going to come back east. So.
And what was your motivation on that, Cindy?
Just being an East Coast girl and wanting my family. I mean, we had young children, and I just wanted to have our family. All our family was on the East Coast between Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and just really wanted to have family around us. So I said, in 5 years, if it's working out, great. But I do want to consider coming back. And literally on the fifth year, at the end of the fifth year.
Yeah, is
when we decided.
Now it's time.
Now it's time to go back.
Yeah. Could you hear the clock ticking, Dave?
I could definitely hear her clock ticking. Yeah. I mean, I loved Michigan. I enjoyed it. And I think the kids enjoyed it. And from a family standpoint, it was a really great time because we were such a nuclear family, we'd made friends out there and so forth, but we really, we kind of carved our own path.
Right.
And that was nice and it felt really good. But, I think after 5 years we were ready to, get back to our East Coast friends, get back to family and also some things had changed at the company that I went to work for. The person that had hired me had, you know, moved on, and so there were changes going on there, and there were all sorts of reasons that, you know, just the timing was good.
And so did the conversation begin then with Fred?
No, it didn't. In fact, when we moved back to the East Coast, I did not go back to work for Fowler.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. Yeah, I had started my own business. I was doing, and then we went on to another business, which you know about.
And just say a paragraph or two about that. So you went to another business, which was like
I started a consulting business. A rep business. Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So I took all the contacts that I had with on the manufacturing side and the distribution side,
right?
And I put that together into a rep agency that handled manufacturers, but on a national scale for their largest customers. So I fell into this niche where I became sort of a VP of sales and marketing for companies that had a great product but didn't have the ability to sell into some of the bigger companies.
Yeah, gotcha.
So I took some of the friction out of there and made that happen for them. And it was a great business and did very well. And we did have some discussions when we got back, and Fred was very open in saying that he wanted me to come back. And I said, Fred, you know, nothing's really changed other than that the grandchildren are now way closer to you and Nancy, so that's really good. But I love you still, but I still don't want to work for you.
Right.
So you guys
started another business, or did you buy a business?
We started another business. Yeah, that's interesting.
I'll say a word. Yeah,
story.
Say a word or two about that.
So our youngest was going off to – our oldest was already in college, and the youngest was graduating in a couple of years. And I said – turned to Dave one day, and I'm like, what am I going to do when Kelly goes off to college? I need something to do. And previous to that, I had been an interior designer for 20-something years. Still enjoyed it, but kind of it had lost its luster for me. Always been creative, always wanted to do something with handmade or with my hands, and came up with a recipe for fortune cookies. And so I decided to pursue making these cookies and seeing if people would like to buy them. And actually went to Dave, and I'm like, okay, you're the marketing expert. I've got this great idea. What do I do? And he said, you know what you need to do? You need to go to our local hospital in York, Maine, go talk to the gift shop, and show her the cookies and see what she says, because they're pretty impressive. And so I made my samples. It took me all day. Made my samples, packaged them up, and brought them down to the gift shop, and she loved them, and I had 3 dozen, and she bought all of them. And I sat and waited for the phone call. Little market test.
Yeah.
And I sat and waited for the phone call, and within 2 days, she called me back, and she said, I want 3 dozen more. I said, all right. So I packed up my goodies and went to Exeter Hospital. Same thing. And so that's basically how we started.
Oh.
Using hospital gift shops, because they're not-for-profit.
Yeah.
So they can get a nice price for them, and it was a repetitive business, a gift item, but also a treat.
Wow.
And, that's how it started. And then...
And you were doing it all. You were making the cookies, designing the cookies, making the cookies,
we were
delivering the cookies.
Making the cookies.
Collecting
so
the receivables.
Collect everything.
Yeah.
And it kind of grew organically, but it kind of grew out of control, because I was doing everything in my kitchen.
Sure.
So about a month or two into the business, there was a restaurant across the street from us in York, Maine, and she was closed on Mondays. So I asked her if I could use her commercial kitchen. I had this great idea, and it was going well. I'll provide my own, you know, I just need your machines. I need your ovens. I need your space. I'll provide my own ingredients, and you'll never know I was there. And she said, absolutely. And I said, well, I want to pay you rent. And she said, no.
Wow.
This is
good friend.
Good
yeah.
friend.
Yeah.
Wonderful friend. And I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
And for about 9 months, every Monday I would go. And, you know, starting out making 6 dozen cookies, and by the time the 9 months was over, I had grown out of that. I mean, I was schlepping back and forth, and the business grew very, very fast. So to the point where Dave could see what was happening, and he started to pitch in and was helping me deliver cookies.
Yeah.
And it grew so fast that we ended up saying, all right, I can't keep just baking one day a week. This has to turn into we're baking all the time. And took a loan out from my mom, $80,000. And she was very supportive of everything that I always wanted to do and yeah. everything that Dave yeah. and I wanted to do. And so I bought equipment.
Wow.
Bought two convection ovens. We rented a space in Rollinsford, New Hampshire in the old mill buildings.
Yeah.
And set up shop. And it's funny when you, I think when you put it out there to the world, I mean, this was, you know, this was 12 years ago. I'm trying to remember how long ago this was. But you put it out there to the world and people just want to help. They see something that they like and they want to help you. So we had, actually she's in marketing and she's a sister-in-law, or she's the sister of my sister-in-law, and owned her own company, but had ties to New Hampshire Chronicle. And so she said, you know, I'm going to pitch this to New Hampshire Chronicle and see if they want to do a piece on you. I'm like, fantastic. That would be amazing. So we weren't spending any money on advertising. It was just word of mouth. And so she was able to get in touch with her people at New Hampshire Chronicle. We sent them cookies, and she said, yeah, we want to do it. So they came and they filmed us, and it went, I think that was in, I can't even remember, right before Christmas. And the night it aired, our phone was literally ringing off the hook. We couldn't get the orders out fast enough, and it was all hands on deck. I mean, I had...
That's great.
I had friends coming in baking and packaging, and your sister came, and it was really, it was a fun, fun time. And so we got through that lull, and then somehow Phantom Gourmet saw the New Hampshire Chronicle piece, and they wanted to come do a piece on us. And that was right before Valentine's Day. So they came and filmed, and it just kind of kept growing and growing. Dave was working more. You were kind of full-time with me, right?
Yeah.
At that point,
he had a foot in two canoes.
So Dave would, I was the operations, and he was kind of the marketing and delivery, and I'd make the product, and with the help of very good friends and bakers, and he would get out there and he'd make all the product, and he'd talk to all these people, and he'd find more opportunities for us.
Right.
So.
And so when did this chapter come to an end, and how did it come to an end?
So, well, we got to the point where the cookie business got to the point where we were actually looking for investors. We wanted to automate things because everything was done by hand at
sure.
that point. And I had been on another pitch that we did was to QVC. Mm-hmm. I was on QVC twice. We sold 14,000 cookies in 7 minutes. Which is a lot of cookies.
Yeah. A lot of cookies.
That's a lot of baking to do. Yeah.
A lot of baking. So much fun, but so laborious. And so we were looking to automate. And right about that time is when we got a phone call that my dad was ill.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to take a good long look at Dave leaving cookies.
Yeah.
And going to Fowler
yeah.
to take it over
yeah.
and keeping cookies, my running it myself. And yeah. I just was at that point where I kept it for another year or so. We had about 300 stores that we were in.
Wow.
Mostly Hallmark stores all across the country. And it was a tough decision, but I was ready for him to make this move and for us to, it would have been a lot. To do both.
Yes, or maybe even impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did sell the business.
So you sold the business because I saw a cookie last night.
Yes.
So they're still making those cookies.
They're still making the cookies.
That's cool.
They're still in this website that we built and the videos that we had done for Chronicle.
Chronicle and Phantom
and
Gourmet.
Phantom Gourmet are still on the website.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you're reminding me of a story. I was with a friend one day, and he is the owner of a very large candle business. So when you think candle business, your mind automatically goes to small. But he owns a very, very large candle business. But he talked about how he got started, which is he got laid off from the telephone company. Hmm. And he went home and hung out and watched cartoons and drank a few beers and felt sorry for himself. And he talked to an old girlfriend who said, well, you know, you always used to like to make candles when we were in college. Why don't you make some candles? He always said to cheer you up. And he said, well, how am I going to do that? She said, well, I don't know. If you've got any soup containers or anything, you can just make some candles. So he went into his kitchen and he opened up every container he could get, dumped out all the insides, and melted a bunch of wax and made candles. And he realized one of the candles that he was making was like a beautiful sea blue color. And he had it. He added some aroma and it smelled like blueberry. So he thought on a whim, gee, I've got a friend who's a buyer for L.L. Bean. I'll just take a tray of my candles and see if I can interest them. And of course, you know, the buyer probably did this only as a total favor to the friend.
Sure.
You know, he showed up in Freeport and said, these are my candles. And the buyer looked and said, these are pretty good. And yeah, I said, could you put our name on them? He said, well, I guess so. Yeah, sure, absolutely. We'll get some labels. They said, okay, we'll take 100 dozen. And he said, oh, my God.
Now what?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Sounds like you had a few of those experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. It was a good ride.
It was a very good ride. And it was intriguing to me. One of the things I remember early on about this is that I was reading an article, you know, because I'm trying to do some market research about fortune cookies. And there's a statistic out there. I'll probably get it wrong. But basically, if you receive a fortune cookie, there's a 99% chance you're going to open it and read the fortune.
Right. Of course you are.
And then there's a 75% chance you're going to take that fortune and you're going to read it to whoever's in your company.
Right.
So when you're thinking about being a marketing person and trying to deliver a message, yeah. I mean, how much more powerful can you get than that?
That's great.
You know, right?
Yeah, right.
So I started thinking about, you know, and Cindy was doing a great job coming up with really clever, happy,
feel good
fortunes.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, well, we can do this for, you know, for doctors that are in referrals. We can do, I mean, there's just so many opportunities, law firms and the corporate gifts,
weddings.
So the corporate
weddings,
piece was huge, yeah. Because if you're a corporate marketer and you want to deliver a message, wouldn't you like 99% of the people that receive your gift to open it and read
it?
Yeah. So
it's so unique too.
It's so unique. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway,
it was fun. The cookies were so big that we actually put an engagement ring in one time. Yeah. We would put dollar bills in or $100 bills in. So it was. Yeah.
You two sound pretty enthused. Maybe you need to or want to get back in that business.
I don't think so. It was a lot of hours standing.
It was
a
lot of standing on your feet. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got a call, and your dad is terminally ill.
Yep.
And somehow you made a decision to exit the cookie business because it would have been impossible to do both. Mm-hmm. And Dave goes back into the business. And at that point, were you feeling like, okay, well, this is different because I thought I left the business, but I've got a round trip now?
Well, you know, I had made a promise to Fred. You know, I probably wasn't clear about this, but, you know, I said I didn't want to work for him. And I was very clear about that, and he understood that. But I also said, you know, if you ever need me, if the family needs me, if a situation ever comes that, you know, you need me, and it doesn't involve you being my boss, then I'm going to be here for you. So I had made that commitment to him. So, you know, regardless of whether I was going to be there, you know, 6 months or whether I was going to, you know, ultimately be there for 11 or 12 years and ongoing, wasn't determined at that point, but it was clear that, you know, I had made a commitment to him that I would be there in the event that he needed me, and at this point he really needed me.
And in your mind, was it more like 6 months? Was it like you're going to step in and temporarily help out?
To be honest with you, I really didn't know.
Yeah.
All I knew was that, you know, the business, you know, there were a lot of people that were depending on this business. You know, obviously the employees, you know, we had long relationships with the suppliers that, you know, Cindy and I know, you know, not just on a business level, but on a very personal level.
Right. In Europe and in Asia.
Yeah. So, you know, there were and customers and so forth. And you know, I was still operating in this industry,
yeah.
You know, through my consulting business. So, you know, there were a lot of stakeholders out there that needed that we needed to address. So I didn't know how long it was going to be, or even whether or not he might, you know, snap through this and be back. But the point, but early on, it was just, you know, we need to do this, and
somebody needed to step in.
Yeah, that's a pretty
authority. Yeah,
but that's a pretty unusual and amazing story, though, right? Because usually in those situations, the person you need to come in has to be all in. But it's hard to be all in if you don't know if you're all in forever or all in for six months, or right?
Yeah.
So how did you, did the employees in the company, they must have accepted you as coming in that role. Was that easy or hard?
It was incredibly easy. I mean, it was very difficult dealing with all the family and the personal issues and the health issues.
Yes.
And that part of it was excruciatingly hard. But the transition into the business was extremely easy. You know, I don't know how to articulate this really well, but there are times in your life where you just feel like I'm doing what I should be doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to explain it beyond that.
And you knew it.
And I knew it.
Yeah.
It just felt like it. You know,
I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to put it any more articulately than that, but that's how I felt. And I think the employees, you know, Fred was the guy.
Yeah.
All decisions went through Fred. And they knew that, you know, if not for me stepping in, from an employee standpoint, they certainly wouldn't have known who else was going to do this.
Yes.
You know, because I knew the suppliers, I knew the customers, I knew the product line, I'd worked there before. I knew, and most of the employees that were there at that time, you know, I'd known because they were there, you know, 10 years earlier.
Well, you know, I guess, of course, the two of you were lucky to have Fred, but boy, he was lucky to have the two of you. Because I would say I can't remember another story in my experience where you have an entrepreneur who I call a severe entrepreneur. As I said, I say that very affectionately. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But usually those people are challenged to be able to attract and retain talent.
Yeah.
So if there were something that happened quickly that you needed help, it would be hard to find.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, it's like super lucky.
On both sides.
Yeah.
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 And I think there was a lesson there that my dad never really had an exit plan. There was no strategy for...
Of course not.
Yeah. Because he, you know, he thought his father lived to 103.
Ah.
And he thought, I'm going to live that long as well, and I don't need one. So at 78, he passed.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Wow, we just come through a bunch of chapters.
Yeah.
Like, and in each chapter, you two were showing your energy as entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
With each other and with others. So, like, when you grew up, Cindy, did you always think you were going to be an entrepreneur?
Yes.
And how about you, Dave?
Absolutely.
And were your parents entrepreneurs?
They were not. My mom worked at the school as a librarian and...
Yeah.
At the school. I guess my dad was. My dad was in commercial real estate development, so that is entrepreneurial for sure, yeah. I don't think it came from them, but I don't know. You're never quite sure. But I've never been as comfortable working for somebody else as I am working for myself.
Yeah.
I think that's
the heart of it.
That's the heart
we,
of it.
Yeah. We both like working for ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that, and I am in full agreement. However, I would say that I've observed in you an ability that most entrepreneurs don't have, which is you can also do the other, and you've proven it.
Yeah.
Like if you had to work for a larger organization and you put yourself to work, you could do that.
Yep.
Yeah. So most entrepreneurs can't actually do that. They're not employable. Fred wouldn't have been employable,
no,
right?
Never.
So, what chapter? So, we're recording this on September 30th, 2022, here at Bigelow. What chapter is this?
Well, in the evolution of Fowler, it's you know, your team working together with us came up with a really, I think, effective way of describing the evolution of Fowler Company as Fowler 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. 1.0 being Fred, 2.0 being my coming in, and then 3.0 being post transaction. So clearly, from the business side, we've just leapt aggressively into 3.0, which is very exciting, and we can certainly talk about that.
And do you think it opens a new chapter for the two of you personally? Do you think of it that way?
Yeah, and on the personal side, Cindy and I, we feel like we're in. There's a lot of things that have happened, and the timing has been interesting. And in our personal lives, we're in this really interesting sweet spot where we have two wonderful girls. They're both smart, and they have terrific relationships. Our oldest just became engaged. But we're healthy. We now have a little bit more flexibility than we've had in other parts of our lives. But our kids are not married yet. We don't have any grandchildren. We don't have a dog. We don't even have a goldfish. So we have this new chapter where we can be maybe a little bit selfish and take advantage of this opportunity and go do some things that that you might not otherwise not be able to do. So we feel incredibly fortunate and grateful to kind of be entering this new chapter for us, which is, I think, going to involve some fun travel and just doing some things we've never done before. We're like you, we're attracted to the ocean. We have a boat. We're definitely going to use that, and we're going to go to some ports and places and do some adventures and discovery that we haven't had the opportunity to do before. So that's, I think in terms of the next 5 years, mm-hmm. probably, until we have, grandchildren and we have a new set of responsibilities in the next chapter, we have this kind of interesting window that we're really excited to explore.
That's cool.
As a couple, and kind of go back to, going back to focusing on ourselves as a couple and doing some fun things together.
Yeah, I don't think of that as being selfish at all. Actually, I think of it as being a new chapter of exploration, adventure, maybe learning and growing. But I'm going to guess that the learning and growing you do are going to make you even more capable in the next chapter, whatever that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's more adding. And yet, Dave, over the years that we've known each other, during some of that time, you and I talked about you transitioning out of the business, and I think at some point you even had some thoughts of transitioning right out of the business. Yet now, I'm not sure exactly when the switch changed, but at some point in our dialogue together, I saw get more energized about the business and actually being more in the business, and I would say now you're more in the business than ever, right?
That's true. Do
I have that accurate?
You do. I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier when I left Fowler, is that I didn't see any growth opportunity, and that's really the part of being in business that is the most exciting to me, is having a plan, executing against that plan, growing the business. I'm a big believer in team. Building a team, getting the team focused around a vision, executing as a team. Those incredible moments where you win as a team and everybody's rah-rah. That's the stuff that gets me up in the morning. That's the part that gets me really excited. And now that we've gone through this recapitalization and we're beginning on Fowler 3.0, and we have the wherewithal to really make some changes and do some M&A and do a lot of the things that you'd like to do, I find myself completely re-energized. You're absolutely right. And it's mostly due to the fact that I'm really excited about where we're going, and we're going to be able to build again.
So some of the business owners listening to this podcast are probably thinking to themselves, well, okay, this sounds like a really together couple, and they ran this business over the past numbers of years, and we hear what Dave is saying about growth, but really why would he have had to go seek out a new investor? Maybe he could have just like gone to the bank and borrowed some money, and you could have had the same thing, and you could continue to own 100% of the business.
Yeah.
What's your response to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, we had stakeholders. So Cindy and I own a controlling interest of the business, but you know, we have her brother is a partner of ours, and I think just like with Fred, maybe, and probably with a lot of other people that are listening to this, you get to a point. I'm 63. You get to a point in your career where you become risk adverse, like Fred was when I was working for him 25 years ago. And that's just not a good place for an entrepreneur to be. It's not challenging. It's not exciting. It's maintenance. And maintenance is just something that I'm not particularly good at, which is why I probably became, you know, less engaged. So we had other stakeholders. We made some really big bets early on, and they came and they worked out really well. There are some other really big bets that, you know, need to be made, and I think Cindy and I got to the point where we just weren't willing to put our chips on the table anymore, or all of our chips on the table. You know, we didn't want to sacrifice, you know, our entire net worth to chase, you know, a new opportunity where, you know, 10 years ago I would have.
Yeah, I mean, so I think so many people will resonate with what you just said, where, you know, I've heard it said, like, someone would say, like, well, we really ought to spend more time expanding in Europe and Asia. And the owner of the business would say, really? I have to bet the farm again?
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So at some point, you might not want to do that. But but let me ask you a more nuanced question. Actually, another thing I've noticed is that in businesses that are successful over long periods of time, like yours has been, they get to a period of equilibrium, and they get to a point where things are going along fine, and they're kind of going along just kind of the way you have set them up. And that's everyone is playing the same role with each other day after day. The stakeholders are the same ones day after day. And sometimes an entrepreneur who has a vision for what it could become that's different than what it is, I've seen almost has to do what I call a significant emotional event. It's almost a change in control of ownership in order to get everyone to realize, hey, this isn't business as usual. It's a new game. In your parlance, it's Fowler 3.0.
Yep.
Did you feel that way?
Absolutely, 100%. I absolutely felt that way. Yeah, that we needed to shake things up. That
and by having some entrepreneurs listening to this might say, wow, you've got a new big constituent at the table who's got big expectations.
Right.
And how did you feel about having a new constituent?
Yeah, I've embraced it. I have the particular group that we went with, we vetted them very well with your help.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I did a lot of background diligence of my own. You guys laughed at me, but I called every single reference they gave me.
Yeah.
And I talked to every single platform investment that they had, you know, currently and in the past.
Yeah.
Got to know some of those owners. Talked to what to expect. So we definitely went into this with eyes wide open. And I think I have a vision of where I think Fowler should be. You know, we in our industry, in the metrology industry, most of our competitors are, you know, multi-billion-dollar worldwide operations. So, we're definitely the Davids fighting the Goliaths here. But I've always felt that there's an imbalance in that the products that we sell in many cases are much superior to what, you know, Goliath is selling. But we just have to get our word out there. We have to get our name out there. We have, you know, customers have to think, Fowler when they're trying to make a decision about product, and not just go to, there was the old saying, you know, you never get fired for buying an IBM. And I think that's true in our industry, and I'm sure it's true in a lot of the industries, people listening to it. So I had this, how do we become, more of a thought leader? How do we get to the point where people, you know, really pick up the phone and call us first, or at least second, versus just always going to the bigger players in the industry. So, and I had a lot of ideas about how to do that, but it's just amazing how, you know, bringing in somebody like our PE partner, who have been down this road before. They understand how to do that. They know how to do that. And to be able to have their ideas at the table, to be able to have their energy at the table, and then to be and back all that up with, you know, the financial ability to do those things is exciting. And it's, you know, you probably hear it in my voice. I mean, this is what gets me charged up.
That's
again.
That's great.
And so it's, you know, it's working. I think it's working for, I know it's working for our employees, for our suppliers. You know, the more we sell, the more, the happier they get. You know, our customers, you know, we've got a long-term relationship with these customers, and, you know, we're going to be around for a long time to help them. And I think more and more and more, we're going to become, you know, that market leader that I always envisioned we could be.
I mean, I'm so impressed with both of your courage, including in this discussion, this last paragraph, because I think most people listening to this podcast would think that people do a recap or sale of their business at the end of their career. And they kind of get that. That makes sense, right? They're going to, quote, retire, unquote. Or some other people would think, oh, they've taken it as far as they can. Maybe they don't have the skill to take it somewhere else, and they're smartly throwing in the towel. Some other people would think, like you said before, that they're just risk averse and they don't want to have to bet the farm again. But you're saying something completely different. What you're saying is that, no, actually, our business had reached a point where it was going along fine, and we had sort of the same people doing the same jobs. These are my vocabulary. We had equilibrium. And that actually I wanted to shake it up. I wanted to break glass. And the way I decided to do that was to bring a new partner in who had these characteristics you just decided. And I'm going to continue to grow the business into what we can become, which we couldn't have done by ourselves. I think that's what you said.
Yes.
Like, that's huge.
And I think, you know, and going back to some of those other points that you made that a lot of other people think about, you know, there also is that desire on my side, you know, and I mean this in the most respectful way possible, to not do what Fred did.
Yeah.
Meaning that we have an exit strategy.
Yeah.
So that, you know, as we start to capture this vision that I have in my head, and I've got the team now moving toward, that there'll be a very smooth opportunity for me to transition out. And for the team just to pick up and drive on in the direction that you know, that these guys are able to take us. So there is that piece of it as well, because you know, Cindy and her family grew up. You know, we laugh about it, we talk about it, but you know, we've been to weddings with our suppliers. You know, we've been to vacations with our suppliers. I mean, these are 50-year relationships, multi-generational relationships that we have with people from Europe and China that that are really important to us. And so I want to be able to, I absolutely was concerned about putting the company on a path for growth, and then also to be able to make sure that all the constituents were going to benefit from it, all the stakeholders, and that also I would be able to have a glide path out. So there is that part of it.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I'm not ready to hang up my cleats yet.
That I had a partner who had the same interest that I did to make sure that I had a good successor.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Cindy, you guys have been through a lot of chapters and a lot of different businesses and ideas. Is there an unavoidable choices to be made between being a good parent and being a successful entrepreneur?
Sorry, rephrase the question.
Are there difficult choices to be made between being a, quote, good parent, unquote, and being a successful entrepreneur?
I think you have to, well, time is one. There's never enough time, right? But I think for both our kids, I think that over the years, when we haven't been with them, when they've seen us grow, I think they've been very proud of us. They've seen us grow. They saw me grow in my design business. They saw me grow in the cookie business. And even though I was taking time away from them to nurture those businesses, there was always that, wow, this is what my mom's doing. This is what my dad's doing. So there was a respect there on both sides.
What do you think your daughters learned about the world of work from the two of you?
That you have to work hard to deserve what you get. We've always worked hard.
So they got your conscientiousness and your focus.
Mm-hmm.
And will they be entrepreneurs, do you think?
Yes, they actually both, I think, are. I think they're both in jobs right now, working for somebody else.
Yep.
But both of them have expressed to me a creative side. I've seen it with them growing up, that there is something that they want to do beyond what they're doing now. I mean, they're both in very respective careers. One is a nurse and one is an engineer. So they're both doing something for, you know, the greater world in their respective careers. But I think that definitely they've seen us be able to have the freedom to make our own schedules and work hard to get there. But I think that's something for each of them that they're going to want to do.
Yeah, I think
down the road.
I don't know your daughters, but if I were them, I would be observing that you two are really whole people who you have ownership of an important enterprise and you've just done this cool thing with it. But you also are, you know, adventurers, explorers. You care about your boat. You care about travel. You care about this stuff. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of lessons for daughters there, right? Oh, my parents are whole people. They're not just like doing this one thing.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So
some people who are listening to this podcast might think, wow, this couple has led a charmed life. I mean, look, they get together, they did this thing, and Dave came out of real estate, they worked for the father's business, they moved to Michigan, blah, 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 that's great. But wow, that's all, they are just success after success after success. Could you point to a couple of places where maybe you didn't have as much success? Maybe you had some, stub your toe along the way, that you had some particular learnings?
Oh my gosh, there's been so many. Yeah, I think the, you know, on the, talking from the Fowler side, I think maybe not so much stubbing the toe, but the parts that were the most difficult, both for Cindy and for myself on the Fowler side, definitely came from the people.
People or family?
Well, I'm saying, you know, as the CEO and president of Fowler for all those years, and then coming in and inheriting, you know, the business that Fred had built and wanting to respect it and build it and grow it and do all the things that I had wanted to do 20 years earlier, but wanting to do it with a group of people that had been loyal to Fred and did things the way Fred wanted to do them. There were a lot of really difficult decisions that had to be made. And some of them were incredibly painful. Mm. Long-term friends, people that we'd known for a long time, that were good at doing things the way Fred wanted them done. I think we tried to give everybody the opportunity to do things, you know, get to Fowler 2.0.
Yeah.
And some of them just didn't understand it, didn't want it, couldn't get there.
Sure.
And we definitely lost some, some important relationships just because of we had to make some really challenging decisions. So that was tough, for sure. There were a lot of business decisions along the way where, you think one thing's going to happen, but another thing happens. You spend too much money on inventory. You don't have, have to go to the bank and explain to them why, you're going to be out of covenant next month. And, there's a lot of, there's been a lot of those along the way where we've grown and got smarter about how we manage the business and think about the business. I would say the biggest, I'm not going to say so much toe stub, but the biggest decisions, the ones where I agonized the most, where I was up all night hating what I was going to have to do in the morning, mostly revolved around having to part ways with people that had been with the company and done a good job and given their heart to the company for a long time, but just weren't going to be the people that could get us to Fowler 2.0.
Right.
And that, I'm going to have that for a long time to deal with. I mean, that doesn't go away.
Yeah, I'm just pausing because I'm reflecting that I'm going to say that it, I would say that's probably all entrepreneurs' biggest challenge, is that if you do grow and evolve, it's natural that you grow and evolve beyond some people.
Yep.
Either because they don't have the capability, or I have found more frequently they actually do have the capability, they just don't want to do it.
I've seen it both ways, sure.
And I've always been of the view that, like, there's no blame, that they're probably doing the job that they always did, even harder that they were doing it, and they're just either unwilling or unable to make the change. And so I've always felt like it's more humane to separate those people quickly to help them find a place where actually they're valued and appreciated, because they're hardworking, typically.
Yep.
But that's a minority view. That's hard to do.
It's a minority view. Yeah. But
a lot of long discussions in the hot tubs over the years.
Yes.
That's where all these we talk about. I mean, I've always been a sounding board for Dave. I've never really been involved with the business, the Fowler business, other than his sounding board. And
what that means, Cindy, is other than every lunch, every dinner, every holiday, every vacation.
Right.
One of our friends and clients said, I never knew if I was going to Thanksgiving dinner or if I was going to a board meeting. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
So there are plenty of people who are either college students or they're out of school, or, you know, they think they want to be entrepreneurs, and they're listening to this and they're thinking, God, I want to do that. What advice would the two of you give to a young, driven, let's say college age person who thinks that they want to be an entrepreneur?
I feel like mentorship is a critical piece of it, you know. You know, for all of the ups and downs, you know, of our relationship, I think through it all, Fred and I, you know, maintained a very healthy respect for one another, and he was absolutely, you know, one of my mentors. And I remember traveling to Europe with him, you know, meeting with suppliers, just sitting back in meetings and understanding what was going through his mind, what he was trying to accomplish, how he was going about doing it, you know, how he viewed the world, how he viewed, you know, our industry. And I really had, you know, an exceptional co-pilot seat next to a guy who I didn't always agree with, but it was just amazing to, you know, to tap into his energy and his view of the world. And then also, you know, how to put things together. So if you have this idea and this is what you want to do, this is how you actually go about doing it. And so I feel like mentorship is something that I would highly encourage, you know, anybody coming out of college or you know, to try to grab onto somebody who's doing, it doesn't even have to be the same industry, but somebody who's doing things the way you think things ought to be done, or you know, so there's something about what they do that is intriguing or exciting to you, and latch onto them, because it's, if I've learned anything over the last 5 years, you know, working with Bigelow, going through this process, is that there's so many people out there that are willing to give of their time. They're willing to, give you the answers to the test. You just have to ask the question. You have to be willing to, you know, to be part of the discussion.
It's fascinating because you're kind of echoing what Cindy said about the cookie business early on. She said there were so many people willing to help me.
Yeah.
You
Absolutely.
Know, that might have something to do with the two of you.
Well, you know, so if you want to, if you know, you have to be somebody that somebody would want to work with.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
So.
Yeah, what a rich coach you had. That I'm just imagining that, you know, again, I feel cheated. I didn't meet Fred, but I'm imagining that after some of those meetings, he would have said, "You dope, why don't you sit up straight? Why aren't you taking notes? Now, don't say that about the price. We're not putting the price down. We're putting the price up. And by the way, you ought to write that guy a follow-up note and blah, 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 blah." And you were ready to kill him sometimes, probably.
No doubt.
But maybe the fact that he wasn't your father, that, you know, I know he's your father-in-law, but still, there was a separation there.
Yeah, a degree of separation, I think. Yeah.
You think that was helpful?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
And I think, honestly, when I remember when we did leave for Michigan, summoned me down to their home. And we had already broken the news to them that we were leaving. And they didn't like it. They told me right out they were so sad. But they also said they were so proud.
Oh, cool. Yeah, very cool.
So that was nice.
So let's say we go to sleep tonight and magically we wake up tomorrow and magically it's October 3rd, 2032, 10 years from now. And while we're asleep, incredibly powerful and positive changes take place at Fowler. Like real miracles happen. And Fowler begins to become what you've hoped it will become. So now it's 2032. You go into the office, you go into the organization, and you're incredibly proud of what you see, Dave and Cindy. And as you take in the vision and you look at it, what do you see?
For me, the vision is that what Fred started, and you know, I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but we have two distinct products that we sell. On the one hand, we sell very mechanical hand tool type products, and that's how the business started. On the other side, we sell very highly engineered products. And on the highly engineered side, you know, these are products that allow customers to do things in a very automated way. And it's clear that in the marketplace today, U.S. manufacturing, and it's a welcome shift from my standpoint, that you know, manufacturers are making the best products in the world here in the United States.
Yes.
The innovation is amazing. The you know, the level of sophistication, you know, everything's getting smaller, it's getting faster, and it's just amazing to me. It's the part of the business that I love. So, what I've tried to do to position Fowler in a way that we are in front of that curve. So, as manufacturers look to do things leaner, faster, more integrated, more closed loop in our terms. You know, we've tried to bring on products and bring on talent and move the company in a direction where we're ahead of this, so that we can go into customers and we can offer them, you know, a turnkey solution. The part gets made, you know, we inspect the part, all the data about that inspection goes back to the machine that's actually making the part. It changes the configuration, and they can run lights out, and they can see, you know, they can continue to make great product, the best product in the world. They can reduce their scrap, they can improve their profitability, and you know, airplanes fly and cars move, and all the cool things that's supposed to happen, all the cool things that are supposed to happen happen. And I just I want Fowler and Fowler's suppliers to participate in that. And so, you know, what I see 10 years down the road is I'm going to walk in, and we're going to have people. We're going to have different divisions that are going to be, you know, Fowler Automation, and the automation guys are going to be writing software, and things are going to be, you know, coming off of production, going through inspection, quality control. And you know, back to the machinery, and the whole system's going to be working in a way that is different than the original Fowler company.
Right.
You know, we laughed. We had a fun night last night. Thank you very much again.
That was great fun.
But and Chris and Stephen were hysterical when you know, they presented Cindy and I with some mops.
Yes.
Right. So. Fowler Company, we didn't talk about this, which is fine, but Fowler Company started selling mops and brooms to hardware stores.
Right.
And then they pivoted away from the hardware business into the metrology business. And so I see this as that same pivot. You know, we're pivoting away from, you know, the hand tools, the micrometers, calipers, and the things that we'll always continue to sell, but we're pivoting into a new world, into, you know, manufacturing 4.0. And so 10 years from now, that's my vision, is that we are going to be a thought leader. We're going to be have the you know, the service support, the after sale, the, you know, the engineering ability on the front end, to really work with the finest manufacturers in the world, who we already work with today, but work with them in a much more engaged way than we do today, and be really part of their whole manufacturing process.
Almost like a global Fowler Global one-stop solution for metrology.
Exactly.
Yeah. Love it.
I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. We believe that entrepreneur owner managers are the most powerful pro-social and pro-economic force on the planet. And it's for that reason that we dedicate our firm, Bigelow, to working exclusively with them. At Positive Enterprise Value, we freely share our learning so that you can absorb from the experiences of other private business owners with skin in the game, just like you. Bigelow is widely regarded as the M&A advisor that deals exclusively with high-performing entrepreneur owner managers. Our scrappy independent boutique firm only offers one service, that is to help build and someday capture enterprise value. You can find all of the episodes on this podcast on Bigelow's website, which is BigelowLLC.com.